I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest is Wendy Murphy. She's the director of the Women's and Children's Advocacy Project at New England Law / Boston, where she teaches sexual violence law. In addition, she's an impact litigator specializing in the constitutional and civil rights of abused women and children. So first, thank you again for your work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program again.
Oh, I'm very glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks. So I want today to talk about the Judicial Language Project. Can you talk about that, but first embed it in the larger culture in which we live of and embed it in the context of men's sexual violence against women?
Yeah, sure. And it matters to put it in context because language is part of the picture, part of the big picture of why we have such high incidence rates and have for a very long time. So the short story is we have an enormous problem, epidemic level problem of sexual violence in this country. It is not always female victims and it is not always male offenders, but it is mostly female victims and male offenders. And that's been the case for, decades, centuries, the beginning of time, frankly. But the problem unique to America is that our laws against sexual violence have been designed from the beginning from a baseline of male ownership over women's lives generally. And premise has colored our inability to deal with the problem effectively because we're always crawling out from this presumption culturally and socially and legally that there is a male entitlement to women's bodies. Male sexual access to women's bodies has always been and still is a male entitlement in this country, and it's a bipartisan male entitlement. That's one of the reasons our laws continue to be so ineffective. Neither party, neither major party, the Republicans or the Democrats, are good at dealing with the problem because they are led by, for the most part, entitled white men. So that's a little bit of background in the sense that we're stuck in this society where no one's actually in charge, no one's actually taking the lead with regard to meaningful reforms. We've tried reforms over the years, try to repair some of the structural problems in our laws generally, and then some of the systemic problems as well with regard to how the police treat sexual violence, how prosecutors treat sexual violence, how judges treat sexual violence, how juries treat sexual violence. But the fundamental problem is there's no leadership that actually cares about effective reforms because, again, the people in charge of the systems and the institutions where we would need reform to take place are led predominantly by the very men, mostly white men, who are unwilling to give up their entitlements. So that's important. And then just if you look at the raw numbers and just, who's being assaulted and what is it doing to our culture, the numbers vary and you can argue about the methodology and the variety of studies that speak to this issue. But we know that 1 in 3 girls is sexually assaulted before she graduates high school. We know that women in college suffer extremely high rates of sexual assault in the university environment. In fact, the data shows they're more likely to be sexually assaulted if they go to college than if they don't, which is pretty sick when you think about that. It's almost a built-in deterrent to women, better not to get educated. And then over the lifetime, some studies show as many as 1 in 2, and I think it's probably a little higher, women endure some kind of sexual assault in their lifetime. And for many victims, they suffer many sexual assaults. So it's really hard to grasp the true numbers because so many victims suffer over and over again. And because they often don't report, and we have really horrifically bad tools for measuring. Our culture, I think, is designed to create artificially low numbers in the instruments we do use. So it's hard to get people to rise up about it because it's hard to really capture the nature of the problem. And let's face it, it's something that makes people very uncomfortable. And it makes them uncomfortable because we all like to think that the world is a safe place and that we're all civilized and that, this is a democracy and the laws are designed to prevent sexual violence. But if you really unpack it and deconstruct our laws, it's very obvious that our laws are actually designed to permit rather than prevent sexual violence. So it's no surprise that we have such high rates today, and they really haven't changed in decades, even despite all the money we're spending and all the work that some of these organizations are doing and have been doing for decades, the numbers haven't changed. In 1993, a national study was done. Joe Biden, I think, was responsible for submitting it to Congress. It was subtitled Detours on the Road to Justice. And that study found that only 2% of rapists spend even one day behind bars. A study like that was then done in 2012, essentially to see whether we've gotten better. And the number of rapists who spend even one day behind bars went up to a whopping 2.5%. So in 30 years or so, we went up by 0.5%. And one of the problems is that a lot of the organizations that purport to be doing anti-violence work, some of the national groups that get the most funding, they're not actually permitted because of their funding sources. They're not actually permitted to do meaningful reform work. And some of them, frankly, are just shills for the Democratic Party. I hate to be so blunt about it, but it needs to be said that they are much more likely to do partisan work than they are to do effective reform work. And that's hard for the public to see. So, you know, you get the sense that we have a lot of advocacy groups out there doing meaningful work because you read about them and they're, you know, they're in the news a lot. But if you really look at what they're doing, they tend to perpetuate the status quo. They tend to be responsible for keeping victims happy as opposed to shining a light on and taking aggressive activist steps, marching in the streets and so forth, to fight for better laws, better police policies, better prosecution efforts. You know, for example, most prosecutors decline about, depending on the prosecutor, 50 to 70% of the sexual assault cases that are brought to their attention. If you've got a prosecutor that's declining one in two or more, at least 50% of the cases that are reported, obviously you're not going to have an effective justice system. And the message gets out very quickly to offenders that this is something you can get away with. And the people that are sending you that message are the law enforcement officials that are supposed to be protecting us from this kind of harm. Then I'd say you've basically got a system that is designed to keep victims silent because they know that if they report, nothing's going to happen. And really, that's where we're stuck. And part of the solution and part of the problem really is how we talk about this problem. One of the things that's interesting about the Judicial Language Project that I created at my law school at New England Law Boston, I think 15 years ago now. I think it was 2005. One of the interesting things about it is that it was the first, and it isn't the only one now, but it was the first one in the nation, first project in the nation to bring attention to the language we use when talking about all forms of violence against women, but sexual violence in particular. Because the reason I came up with the idea for the Judicial Language Project is that as an academic and as a teacher and as a practitioner, I was reading court cases all the time that just made me a little uncomfortable in my gut. And I couldn't quite put my finger on it. You know, feminists say this over the years. You hear this sort of thing over and over again, that feminists or you know, all sorts of people who are suffering, but they don't have language to describe why they feel the way they do with regard to discomfort. That's how I felt. I felt uncomfortable with what I was reading, but I couldn't put my finger on it because I didn't have the language, because my culture didn't give me the language to be able to identify the nature of the problem I was seeing. And what I was seeing was language in court decisions about violence against women, predominantly sexual violence, that were descriptive in ways that didn't seem to reflect the severity of the victim's experience. And there were other problems as well. I can tell you the one that really got me motivated to try to create a formal project was reading over and over again about the oral rape of a victim. In other words, a penetration of a victim's mouth in a sex-specific way. That was always described, and it was often done this way when the child was a victim, that the victim performed oral sex on the defendant. And that used to just curdle my stomach. I mean, it was so uncomfortable for me to read that language, but I couldn't understand why it made me uncomfortable, because I'm not trained as a linguist. I'm not trained as a sociologist. I just knew it didn't seem right. So I forced myself to read as much research as I could, sociolinguistic research, to try to get a handle on why that terminology felt uncomfortable to me. And I was lucky that I was able to uncover a lot. There's a lot out there. It was originally, the research I ended up finding was mostly done in Canada. Some was done here, but it was originated in Canada. And there were these academics there who spent a lot of time and energy identifying problematic language in courts with regard to sexual assault cases. And then they literally pieced it together with the research that linguists and sociologists had identified as measurably causing harm in society. And yet they made it available to people like me and lay people in an understandable way, so that I could become part of that circle of understanding. And I started with that research and developed at my law school the Judicial Language Project, which entails using that research to critique court decisions and news stories. We actually also do this for newspapers and, you know, other and television and other news stories about sexual violence. We use that research to critique the language that's used to describe sexual violence. And then we do an analysis of the language and provide the research so that when we send our critique along, whether it's to an editor at a newspaper or to the Chief Justice of a Supreme Court in a particular jurisdiction, we are able to say, this language is inappropriate and it's harmful, and here's the science that proves that it's harmful. And then we don't just, slap them on the hand. We also provide alternative language choices so that they can do it better the next time. And so we started doing this. We were the first in the country to do it 15 years ago. And what was interesting about it was I was bringing my law students in to become part of this project. And many of them, like me, you know, as I felt when I started this work, they said, I don't know anything about linguistics and I don't know anything about sociology. Some of them had been trained in sociology, but this was really a unique project in the sense that I was crossing these disciplines and forcing them to understand each other. So sociologists and linguists, in a sense, were learning from and helping to train law students, and in turn, law students were working with and helping the sociologists and linguists to understand law. And we were, in a sense, collapsing the wall between them and really getting this multidisciplinary team of law students to think differently. Instead of just being trained to become a lawyer and trained to understand the law and trained to apply the law and trained to accept language passively, which is true for all of us. We all read and accept our language passively when we're reading news stories or whatever. We don't think critically about the language choice that the editor uses or that the reporter uses. We just accept it. And of course, that then becomes incorporated into our own mental software. But this is a project that teaches law students to think differently about the language they're reading and to, in a sense, play a bit of an activist role as lawyers. So, you know, don't just perpetuate the problem. Be critical consumers of the case decisions that you're reading and the language that judges are using and the language that lawyers are using, and say something about it. Speak up about it. And in fact, before you become a lawyer, while you're a law student working on this project, here's an interesting way that you can participate in real reform work before you're even a lawyer. Here's a way you can try to reform the system, maybe not by going to the legislature and changing the laws, but by changing the way we talk, which absolutely has enormous impact on how people feel about sexual violence. And that's a very big something to deal with.
So I have thank you so much for that. I have a few comments and then I'll turn you loose again. And one of them is that this of something that you were talking about, you didn't have the language. It felt kind of off or bad, or to use sort of childish language, yucky. I remember when I was younger, very young, seeing the movie Dr. Zhivago, the one that starred Omar Sharif and Julie Christie back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't see it in the 60s. I saw it when I was a teenager. And there's a rape scene in there with Laura, where Laura is raped by Evgrav. And it really disturbed me. And it took me about 10 years to figure out why it bothered me so much. And, I mean, apart from the fact that it's a rape scene, is that at the beginning of the scene, she's pushing him away. And by the end of the scene, she puts her arms around his back and pulls him close. And you see scenes like that in movies all the time. V for Vendetta, the main character tortures the woman. And the first thing she says is, you know, I love you so much, or I love you, or I missed you, or something. And you see this all the time in film and TV where, the worst one ever is the Straw Dogs, Dustin Hoffman, and I can't remember the female actor's name, from the 70s, Sam Peckinpah movie, I believe. Anyway, there's a terrible, terrible rape scene in there where by the end of the scene, she's doing it again. She's pulling him close, where the message is, if you just push hard enough, then it's no longer rape. It's she wants it. And
so yeah,
one thing. And then another. So another is, this just drives me bonkers that for whatever reason, I read a lot of news about various death penalty cases. And there's a guy, I don't know if he's on death row or if he's been executed, I don't remember. But anyway, he killed his wife. He tortured and killed his wife. And the way I've seen a lot of articles start about this is he loved her too much to let her go. And that just makes my, you know, I don't know. It makes me crazy. So okay, I'm done.
Well, you know, this kind of conversation is one of the most important results of having a project like the Judicial Language Project, because there needs to be a place for people like you to be able to say, I feel uncomfortable, and what does it mean? Does it have meaning, and why, and so forth. And that really is why we did this, because otherwise we accept those movie scenes, and they go into our brains, and they feel normal, even when they're not, because you just get pounded and pounded with information over and over and over again that you start to become the abnormal visual. You start to embrace it because even though it isn't normal, nobody would be showing you all these images unless this is the way it ought to be and there's something wrong with you for feeling that discomfort. So obviously, having something like the Judicial Language Project is a wonderful liberating space for someone like you to be able to go in and check in and say, hey, I have a problem with this scene. Is there something about this that you know, that you can talk to me about? And am I wrong? Is there an explanation for my discomfort? And we don't do that for people. We just don't have spaces like that for people. The internet is obviously a wonderful place where there are many more spaces for these kinds of conversations to take place. And you know, thoughtful people often trust themselves even against the images they get pounded with. But I think, you know, pornography is a really, really influential example of a medium that, I don't know what to call it, a problem that tends to normalize violence against women in a way that's exceedingly difficult for, especially for men, to perceive as harmful, because when they see it, it is titillating. And if you're learning information and your brain is growing, especially for young kids, and what you're seeing feels tingly in your man parts, but your brain thinks it's horrific because you know that hurting human beings is a bad thing to do, you're going to get very confused about which part of your body you ought to trust, your brain or your penis. It's really dangerous stuff. Pornography is probably at the top of the list of a type of propaganda that normalizes, and it's not quite language, but it includes a language problem, obviously, because the derogatory terminology that's used in porn against the woman also feels not only normal, but titillating. And so, of course, boys are going to grow up as men to think that this is something delightful because it feels delightful to them and it appears delightful to the woman. And it's hard to overcome that because the feeling of being sexually aroused kind of trumps your rational brain. So that's important. And then, you know, then you get these quote unquote normal movies that are award winning and that do it in a slightly more subtle way, make you think that's not only acceptable behavior, but delightful behavior because it won an Academy Award. We don't give Academy Awards to films that are offensive and derogatory and sexist. And actually we do. But even Gone with the Wind, I mean, I think that's always at the top of the list of the most famous movies, the best movies of all time. And there's a really ugly rape scene in that film that that even, you know, feminists and women's rights types will romanticize about. It's just hard. It's hard to fight against that tide. It's hard to fight when you don't have a place to have a conversation and to have the language that you need to be able to make sense of your conflicted feelings. The loved her too much thing, I find that an unfortunately very common sentiment in domestic violence cases, which again is part of language problem. The notion that it's ever possible to love someone so much you kill them, there's no place for that sentence. There is no place for that sentence because even if you love someone very much, and let's agree that O.J. Simpson very much loved his wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, when you choose to be violent to that person, and whether you kill them or not, but certainly if you kill them, when you make the choice to be violent, that is the antithesis of love, and it doesn't matter what you think because it isn't about you. It isn't about you. You choosing to label your behavior as an expression of love doesn't make it love. Does not make it love. You're not in charge of the objective meaning of the word love. You're just not in charge of it. So it doesn't matter. Even if in some twisted version of your subjective reality, you think you killed her because you loved her too much, even if that's how you feel, you are irrelevant because you're not in charge of the meaning of the word loved. And we have to be really careful to correct people and be unabashed. No, be proud to correct people. We don't do it. We don't do it for a lot of different reasons, including that this is a topic area that, you know, in certain areas of society in particular, you're not supposed to talk about. Well, I do it anyway, because if I can feel uncomfortable when I'm reading a news story in the Boston Globe because of their language choice, if they're allowed to make me uncomfortable, then I should be allowed to make other people uncomfortable in correcting the language that discomforts me. That's how I think about it. I want to make people, in a sense, comfortable in their discomfort by giving them tools that they can rely on to help them make sense of things they otherwise accept blindly and that really do corrupt them. I think the word corrupt is appropriate because, you know, we're not born with the mental software that drives us to hurt. We may be born with the mental software that drives us to survive, but we're not born with a desire to hurt. I don't believe that. We have to be manipulated to feel that that's an acceptable behavior. And I think we can do a better job, especially with regard to language, being critical consumers of the information we take in. Yes, we should look at it. You know, some parents will say, well, I don't let my children watch X, Y, and Z. I have five children, and when they were young, I didn't forbid them to have Barbie dolls or watch those kinds of television shows. I gave them Barbie dolls, and then we talked about the body parts. And, you know, we watched shows that I thought were offensive, and then we talked about why they were offensive. I wanted my kids to have the critical thinking skills that if I didn't let them see those things, they wouldn't have had. And not surprisingly, my daughters cut off the hair of their Barbie dolls and, you know, broke their necks and did stuff that, you know, wasn't exactly, you know, or pulled, they just thought it was funny. Like you could pull the head off and put a different head on the other body. And they just didn't see the Barbie dolls the way a lot of kids did. And I thought that was wonderful. They didn't want to dress them. In a sense, they wanted to rebuild them and reconstruct them. And I liked that. I liked that very much.
Earlier, we talked about the, you know, he loved her too much trope. And there's a great line by R.D. Lang, the psychiatrist, who, by the way, was also a batterer, but leaving that aside. He had this great line about, he called it violence masquerading as love. And
yep.
I love that.
Yeah, I do too. There's a lot of masquerading in the world when it comes to hiding violence against women. I give a talk about just invisibility, the problem of invisibility and how to create visibility. Because historically, if you look at violence against women, the ways in which the suffering women endure is rendered invisible, that, you know, comes from a variety of sources, and it isn't just language, but language plays an important role. And creating visibility isn't that difficult, but the first step is seeing the problem, identifying the problem, understanding the problem. And, you know, then you're hypersensitive for the rest of your life. And a lot of people yell at me for that. Oh, I used to see things this way, and now I just can't get this image out of my mind because of you, Wendy. And I say, yeah, but doesn't it feel better? And, you know, I think for some people, they'd rather not know. They like their comfort level the way it is. And it does ask a lot of people to dig in, and that core feeling we have in our gut about how the world works, that people are nice, that you know, that things are civilized. You got to give that up a little bit to be able to make progress, whether it's about this issue or anything else. You got to be willing to give yourself a little discomfort. And even when I've tried cases in front of juries, to me, the evidence is overwhelming, but I know they're sitting there thinking, I can't get my head around the fact that this man would have raped this woman. He looks just like my next door neighbor or my son. I don't want to ever imagine my son being capable of this. So I'm going to find him not guilty because it makes me feel better. It makes me feel better than if I see him as a rapist, I have to feel uncomfortable about men I love in my life. So you don't yell at the jury and say, don't be stupid. Don't be stupid. And, you know, just use your common sense and figure it out. You really have to give them permission to be uncomfortable. And it's a challenge because it is. And we should, you know, we should screen jurors for their, frankly, in my opinion, no one ever does this, but we should screen jurors for their capacity to be self-critical, because that's the kind of juror who's much more likely to transcend these biases and these language barriers and to see the truth objectively in a case rather than getting stuck in that desire to feel comfortable.
So we've been talking a fair amount about language in general. Can you give, I don't know, four or five examples from judicial cases or from language of the court itself that have been, we can call it objectionable, we could call it rapey, we could call it, you know, eroticizing sexual violence. Can you give some examples of some court statements that are what we're talking about?
Yeah, there's so many good ones.
You gave the one with
and rapey,
oral sex. Yeah. Can you give some more?
Yes. And let me also just tick off that I've created my own list of what I call types of problems. You said rapey. I call them just problematic terms and phrases, and then there are categories. Competing definitions is one. Needless eroticism is another. Harm-free words is another. Vague terms is another. Gratuitous information. Active passive voice, and then blaming or judgmental language. Those are the categories. So let me give you a couple of examples. Under competing definitions, one of my pet peeves is the phrase statutory rape. Statutory rape has meaning under the law in a lot of different jurisdictions. But basically what statutory rape means, and I urge people never to use it, that's why it's one of my pet peeves, basically it means you raped a child, because statutory means there's a statute that says anyone under this age is a child, and they cannot consent as a matter of law, period. But when you call it statutory rape, it almost sounds like technical rape as opposed to rape of a child. In 50 different states in this country, we have 30 different phrases to describe the rape of a child. And what that does to us as a culture is, and they never just call it rape of a child, but what that does to us as a culture is, number one, it makes it very hard for us to have a conversation about the same topic because we're always using different terminology. We want to have consistency. We should just be calling it rape of a child across the board. Among other things that would help us measure the incidence rates a lot better, we cannot get an effective measure of how many children are raped in this country because we don't even call it the same thing state to state. So that's an example of a competing definition. Another is the word sodomy. I mean, sodomy has so many weird definitions. In some of the run-of-the-mill dictionaries, it's described as any form of sexual intercourse held to be unnatural or abnormal, especially intercourse or anal intercourse or bestiality. That's one definition. Another is copulation with a member of the same sex or opposite sex or with an animal. And then under the law, it's cunnilingus, fellatio, analingus, or anal intercourse against a person's will and by force, which is interesting. And then the problem is, of course, for gay people, sodomy is delightful. So, you know, we really ought not to be using the word sodomy. It is not a word that should be criminalized. It doesn't make me think about violence. It's confusing to people. It has an erotic tint to it, and it makes it harder for people to feel bad for the person who suffers an anal rape. It should just be called rape, period. The same is true for incest. Incest is just the rape of your own child, basically. Well, it's rape within a certain degree of consanguinity within a family, but it basically means you rape someone in your family. So why are we giving it a separate label? Incest makes it sound different. It's not different. If anything, it's an aggravated form of rape because of the betrayal of trust involved. We ought not to be using the word incest to make it sound different from rape. Certain types of erotic words similarly distance us from the harm and the pain and the suffering victims experience. Words like intercourse, sex, oral sex, climax, fellatio, panties, fondle. These words do not evoke in me a sense of suffering. They, if anything, are erotic and create a bit of titillation. They're not appropriate when you're trying to write about violence. You ought to be using words of violence. Those words are always inappropriate, and they are ever present in news stories and in court decisions. Vague terms, some of the most common are words like molest, sexual contact, lewd behavior, abuse, grope, assault. Assault is probably the one I like to focus on the most because you read it a lot in the newspapers and you hear it a lot in television news because it's kind of a universal term to describe the nature of being touched in a sexual way. But if you really think about it, sexual assault doesn't mean anything. It doesn't mean anything to you directly because it could mean somebody touched your rear end, or it could mean you were brutally, anally raped at knife point. And so use of the phrase sexual assault, because it's not clear, because it doesn't have universal meaning and it doesn't mean anything in particular, you know it was sexual, you know there was a touching, but because the range is so varied, If you read a story about somebody being sexually assaulted and you hear that the guy got probation, you don't know if you're upset or not, because that might be an appropriate punishment for someone who put his hand on the rear end of a person, but it certainly wouldn't be appropriate if there was a very violent anal rape at knife point. So the phrase sexual assault to me is unfair to victims, and it's unfair to the public that has a right to the truth. Gratuitous information is a kind of an interesting category that I picked up on during the Kobe Bryant trial many years ago, the Kobe Bryant case that never went to trial, I should say, because the news stories repeatedly said that the victim was wearing yellow knit underwear. And I kept writing letters to the editor saying, would you please explain to me why we need to know the color and the style of fabric of her underwear? Would you please explain that to me? It's not necessary. It's not relevant. It's gratuitous. And it was always there over and over and over again. And they never had an answer. They'd say, well, you know, it's the truth, so we want to report the truth. And I'd say, that's crap. You choose what goes in your story on the basis of whether it's relevant or not. You wouldn't put in, you wouldn't put in the color of the car her mother was driving the day before, because it's not relevant. And her yellow knit underwear does not add anything to the story in terms of what helps us understand the truth. Other bits of gratuitous information that are routinely put in news stories and in court decisions, and that we accept because we're so used to it, include things like a victim's prior sexual activity. We'll often read that a victim was a prostituted woman, for example. That's not relevant. I'm sorry, but that makes her vulnerable. Maybe we should talk about how she was targeted because she was a prostituted woman. But past sexual activity tells us nothing about what happened at that moment in question in the case. A woman's mental health background or alcohol or drug history, unless the woman was using drugs or alcohol at the time in question, that oughtn't be in the story. It oughtn't be brought up in court because it doesn't tell you the truth about what happened at that moment in time. But they're common, very common bits of information that are often put in stories. When the crime is sexual assault, you will almost never see those types of information in stories about victims of robbery, larceny, carjacking. You just don't see it. And it's not justifiable. There's no rational reason for the maltreatment of women in sex crimes cases. It's done in order to send a message. If you dare report rape, this is all going to be said about you. So get the message. Don't report. And that's why we have such extremely low, that's one of the reasons why we have such extremely low reporting rates. Another one, and this is an easy one for people to remember, and it's pretty invisible unless you think about it. People don't really process this as a problem. But it's the difference between saying the victim was raped and the defendant raped the victim. Obviously, if you say the victim was raped, which isn't untrue, what you're saying is in a passive voice instead of an active voice. And the offender isn't even in the sentence. He's just not part of the story. And you don't want that. If the victim was raped, and that's what people are reading, they don't get the sense that there was a perpetrator in the event. Because they're not in the sentence, they're not in the story, they're not in the line. Far more important to have an active voice where the subject is the focus and the thing that the subject did is clear. Defendant raped victim. That's rarely used in our storytelling and should be used. Far more often we see language that is passive and the defendant isn't there, victim was raped and is very common. But words like victim had sex with, victim participated in or engaged in the act. Once you do that, once you have the victim participating, you're really giving society permission to blame her as partly responsible for her own rape. If she's engaging in or had sex with or participated, that, and even the word performed, as in performed oral sex, that is a way of almost building in reasonable doubt for the jury. Because once you give the victim any degree of responsibility through that language of participation, you have given the jury permission to reduce the offender's responsibility by 100% down to 90%. Why? Because the victim participated, and that's the 10% discount, and boom, they find reasonable doubt. Really important not to use that kind of language.
Which, by the way, let's say that we're on a street and you are going to rob me, and you pull out a gun and you say, give me your wallet. I am actively participating by giving you my wallet, but they never say, they never put that. I'm making the same point about robbery and nobody would ever say,
yep. That's 100% correct, and that's a really important observation. It's not just about what we're saying and why it's harmful. It's about the fact that we don't say it in other types of stories. You're absolutely right. We would never call a victim of robbery a participant. We'd never say they engaged in, ever, 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 ever. And that's correct. That's actually legally the correct way to write about it, because in the criminal justice system, there's only guilty or not guilty. There's no such thing as partially guilty. You can't be a little bit guilty and the victim's a little bit guilty. That you could do in a civil lawsuit. In a civil lawsuit, in many jurisdictions, you can apportion responsibility. Well, the harm doer is 60% responsible, the victim is 20% responsible. You can do that in a civil lawsuit for money damages. In a criminal case, there's only one responsible party, and that's the harm doer. And he is either guilty or he is not guilty. He can't be a little bit guilty. And that's why legally, even creating the feeling that the victim played some role in causing someone else to offend against her body, even creating the idea through language choice that that's what happened, is a way of diminishing the responsibility of the person who is solely responsible for his criminal behavior. So that's one of the important, you're so smart to point that out, because that's one of the important observations that comes from this training that we do with people, is connecting the dots between language and real world consequences. We don't just feel differently when we're reading the story. It translates in the courts into unjust acquittals, unjust verdicts against offenders based not on the evidence, but on our feeling about the victim having some responsibility for somebody else's criminal conduct, which is legally impossible in criminal law. It's just impossible. And so language plays a really powerful role in creating unjust acquittals in all cases involving violence against women. So thank you for pointing that out. You asked me to give you a couple of real-world stories from the news, so I'm going to read you a couple because they're some of my favorites. There was a prosecution of a guy named Stanley McGee several years ago. This was in Boston, and the guy was charged with rape of a child. Carl Stanley McGee was married at the time. He was charged with rape of a child, and the Boston Globe described the guy as having been accused of molesting a 15-year-old boy. Molesting. And, quote-unquote, performing oral sex on the boy. The public never quite understood this as a serious sex crime case, because every time the Boston Globe wrote about it, they used words like molest and performing oral sex. It was an extremely eroticized story. Now, it so happens Carl Stanley McGee was a man of political influence who worked for the governor, and you know, a lot of the soft peddling of the story was noticed by the public, which is good. But it's just the idea that this was a child. This guy was 38 years old. This was a 15-year-old boy. And to talk about it as a molestation and, quote unquote, performing oral sex on the child, the correct terminology should have been that he was accused of child rape or rape of a child, and that he had forced his penis into the child's mouth or forced the child's penis into his mouth. That would have been the story. That's the correct story. And I know it makes people uncomfortable. When I've done training programs with the Poynter Institute on this issue, sometimes the reporters or editors will say to me, Wendy, that makes people uncomfortable when they're eating their cornflakes in the morning. If we say, force the penis into the victim's mouth, it makes people uncomfortable and they want to read the newspaper and enjoy their cornflakes. And I said, the purpose of a newspaper is not to make people comfortable when they're eating their cornflakes or eating anything else. The purpose is to inform and to tell the truth. You put pictures of people who die in war, you tell horrific stories about violence perpetrated in the streets and especially in wartime. That's a front page story all the time. And you don't worry about making people uncomfortable. You only claim, and this is one of those examples of the masquerading problem that you mentioned earlier, newspaper editors really do want to soft pedal stories about sexual violence, but they masquerade their agenda with concern for their customers being comfortable when they're eating cornflakes. That's a bunch of nonsense. Here's another one. The New York Times columnist Bob Herbert wrote a column condemning the sex trafficking of children, which is a good thing. But as he described the nature of the problem, and he called it a serious crime, that's a direct quote, he also, at the end, complained that this was a problem of, quote unquote, statutory rape. Statutory rape. He soft-pedaled his own story, and he was talking about the selling of children, the selling. Not just raping of children, but the selling of children, and he called it statutory rape, as if this was a mere technicality. Here's another one. Philadelphia Daily News published a story about a teacher in his 30s charged with multiple sex crimes against a 14-year-old whom he impregnated 3 times. The man was accused of beating and threatening the child, forcibly committing vaginal and anal penetration. The reporter who wrote the story described the crimes against that child as, you guessed it, statutory rape. Statutory rape. I could go on and on. Here's another example. I'll ask you a question because this is a fun example of the problem, and it kind of exemplifies the collection of issues. But this is from the Idaho State Journal in 2012. Christopher Cox has pleaded. This is a direct quote from the story. Christopher Cox has pleaded not guilty to charges of sexual abuse of a child under the age of 16. He is facing three felony counts for incidents involving a former junior high school student that allegedly occurred between January and August of last year. Bingham County Sheriff's officials told the Idaho State Journal earlier this year the victim was 14 years old at the time of the incidents. So I will ask you, what did Christopher Cox do?
Probably this student, you know, okay, I'm being cynical here. This is ironic. The student, she was kind of hot, and so they got together, they hung out, they went to the park, things got out of hand, and they had sex.
So I'm, of course I'm going to slap your hand for saying had sex, because when it's a child, it's always rape. My point in asking you what did Christopher Cox do is to emphasize that you would read this entire story and have absolutely no idea what he actually did. It just says he pleaded not guilty to charges of sexual abuse of a child. It doesn't say what he did. It doesn't say whether he put his hand on her rear end. It doesn't say whether there was anal rape at knife point. It just doesn't say. And the public has a right to know, because there's a big difference between a hand on the rear end and an anal rape at knife point. The public has a right to know, and that is nowhere in this story. So we don't have a strong sense of how to feel about Christopher Cox, and most of us do exactly what you did. We default to the most comfortable narrative we can. What narrative makes us feel okay, not great, but okay about what Christopher Cox did? And we romanticize. Well, she had a crush on him. He was an older teacher, but this was kind of one of those things, teacher's pet, and it got out of hand, and it was just sex. That's the problem. We always default when terms are either erotic or vague. We default, because it feels better, to the least painful image, the least painful narrative that we know, that's already in us, that allows us to feel comfortable. And that story is unfair to the public. It's also unfair to the victim, but it's really unfair to the public. Here's another really powerful example of the problem. Remember the Penn State Jerry Sandusky case from a few years ago? I did a Google search back then because I kept reading the newspapers that were describing Sandusky's rape of children in incredibly erotic and non-harmful ways. Nearly every news source, in fact, that I read said that he, quote unquote, engaged in sexual activity with boys, fondled, quote unquote, performed oral sex. Sexual assault was there sometimes. Intercourse was there and molestation was there. That was basically the only language used. Once in a while, you'd see rape, but that was not common. So in November 2011, while that case was going on, I did a Google search of the phrase Sandusky victim anal sex, and I got 172,000 hits. When I typed in Sandusky victim anal rape, I got only 38,000 hits. That tells you the magnitude of the problem. We're talking about systematic rape of boys, little boys, systematic, and only 38,000 hits compared to 172,000 that use the word sex. Rape just wasn't in the story. And this wasn't one case. The attempt to eroticize and minimize and frankly render invisible the harm these kids suffered was unbelievable. The mainstream news worked really hard to make us comfortable. And I found that repulsive. That made me extremely uncomfortable reading that language over and over. Here are a few examples of court cases that I'll just tick off a few, because the courts are just as bad as the media. From a New York appellate court, forced her to perform oral sex on him. From an Indiana court, molesting and fondling the victim. From another Indiana court, fondled the victim's vaginal area. That's usually called rape. From Washington State, engaged in sexual intercourse. The victim was wearing panties. They're not called panties. They're called underpants. This is from Ohio. The defendant performed oral sex. From Louisiana, the defendant's private part went into her. from, it's unbelievable. It's a, over and over and over and over again, from Minnesota, force the victim to commit fellatio and submit to cunnilingus, commit fellatio. So the victim committed her own erotic crime against the defendant, apparently. Now, this one I'm going to end with, and I know we're running out of time, but I really want you to hear this one because this one takes the cake. This is the description in the statement of facts in an appellate court decision from Ohio. This, I just want you to, actually, no, let me do it backwards. I'm going to read you, no, I'm going to forget it. Start, I'm going to do it the way I suggested. Okay, this is from the statement of facts. Defendant grabbed her from behind, placed his right hand over her mouth, pointed a knife near her face. When the victim attempted to escape, he tackled her to the floor. While flat on her stomach, he straddled her and pinned one of her arms. He said if she did not stay quiet, he would kill her. Despite this threat, the victim was crying, freaking out, and begging for life. He seized the victim's arms and duct taped her hands behind her back. That sounds pretty gruesome, right? That's a very violent crime, horrific crime. Here's what the appellate court said in its analysis section when it had to characterize what the victim went through in order to justify its decision. This is a direct quote from the Ohio Court of Appeals, okay? Quote, he despoiled her of her pants and began kissing her inner thigh. He engaged in fellatio, followed immediately by vaginal intercourse. Despoiled her of her pants. That is what the Ohio Appellate Court said in 2008. It sounds like it's from 1853, but that is what the Ohio Appellate Court said in 2008. There is so much wrong with the language we use when describing violence against women, especially sexual violence. We imply through our language choice that a victim is somehow responsible for someone else's criminal act. We make the behavior sound erotic so that we don't feel bad or really understand and become empathetic with the victim's suffering. It makes it really hard to understand how much suffering the victim went through. When we use erotic terminology, it makes us feel pleasure instead of pain. We make it seem invisible that we can't even interpret or infer from language whether something bad happened because of words like fondle and molest that tell us nothing about what actually happened. And we often eliminate the offender completely. We often eliminate the offender completely from the story by using phrases like she was raped or she was molested or she was assaulted rather than he assaulted her, he raped her. Those are the critical pieces of sociolinguistic research theory and policy that we need to be more mindful of, that we need to teach ourselves about, because no one's teaching it to us. You're not going to learn this in school. You're not going to learn it in college. You're not going to learn it in law school. You've got to self-teach. This is all about self-teaching and becoming critical consumers of information rather than passive puppets and frankly, passive consumers become affected by language choice, whether we want to or not. We can't help it. It's the nature of language. It becomes part of our software, and then we use it against others in ways that are hurtful, but we don't plan to be hurtful. We're not trying to be hurtful. We just can't help it because it's in us. It's in our software. A couple of other things that are a little bit off the chart in terms of being about sociolinguistics include things like using the word accuser in a story. The accuser in a criminal case is the government, not a victim. When we use the word accuser to describe the victim, we're really being very unfair to her because it makes it sound like it's her case versus the defendant. It isn't. The government has made the decision to file charges, which means there's been some vetting. The government is now the opponent. So, you know, the word accuser sounds like it's something the victim is doing to the defendant and threatening his liberty. That is not the case. It is the government that's doing it and threatening his liberty. The victim is a witness for the government. So we really have to not use the word accuser to describe a victim in a criminal case. And we really have to not use the word alleged next to the word victim because the alleger is the state. And the allegation is an allegation of criminal conduct. There is an alleged crime, alleged rape, alleged whatever it is. Alleged isn't even semantically or grammatically correct to attach to the word victim because, again, the thing that gets alleged is the crime. The victim doesn't get alleged. So it's not even correct grammatically to put the word alleged next to a victim. It's okay to say victim of alleged crime, but it is not okay to say alleged victim. And it really weakens her status in the eyes of the reader of the news story to say alleged victim. It just portrays her as inherently suspect because we've attached that word alleged to her, not to the case, but to her. And it's just, and you don't tend to see the word alleged or accuser used in the same way when the victim has been robbed or, you know, any other kind of crime. You just don't see that pejorative use of those terms, accused and alleged. I also dislike phrases like marital rape and date rape. And, you know, some reporters will say, well, Wendy, it gives context so the reader can understand the context. And I said, yeah, but, you know, you don't call it mall rape when somebody gets raped behind a mall. When you call something marital rape or date rape, you're really soft peddling the nature of the crime. There's no reason to do that. First of all, marital rape is usually a more horrific form of rape because of the betrayal of trust that happens. The fact that rape happens between people who know each other, which you might use the which might make you use the label date rape, it doesn't make it a date that turned into a rape. It's just a rape. And it wasn't first a date that went south. And if you use that phrase date rape, you've given the consumer of that information permission to perceive it as something pleasant that might have gone south a little bit. But you don't give them permission to see it as an act of violence first and foremost, or exclusively. You claim you're giving context, but you're actually using a label that diminishes the seriousness in a way that makes no sense. It's not just that I don't like it. It just makes no sense because the suffering in quote-unquote marital and date rapes is usually worse because, again, because of the betrayal involved in, you know, the taking advantage of that intimacy that you have when you as the offender are in that circumstance. You know, I like to think that there are lots of people out there who are mindful of the language they use. And I think the real issue here is whether they have the tools and the information they need to be more mindful. So podcasts like this are critically important because they cause people to say things. And this is my favorite thing that anybody ever says. Wow, I never thought of that before. It's really a, you know, it's just a gift to me to be able to be on your show because I do think that people learn so much from other sources than mainstream news. And they don't, you know, they regret because they'll say, I didn't know. And so they, you know, they're not trying to be harmful. They're not trying to promote and perpetuate the problem, but they are. And they like to be able to have that consciousness, that awareness and that epiphany, if you will, that allows them then for the rest of their lives to be able to say, I'm never going to use that phrase again. And I'm going to tell other people not to use it. I mean, that is how social change happens in a world where women are not yet equal under the Constitution, where our voices don't carry much weight, where we don't own newspapers and control the language people use. And we don't have the power really to produce reforms the way we ought to be able to come full circle to the points I made at the outset, which is that this is all about male entitlement to women's bodies. You know, if women were in positions of power with regard to how policies and laws are made, we wouldn't have such a big problem, but we're not there. So in the meantime, we have to have reforms through mobilization in alternative sources like the internet and like podcasts. And this is where change happens. And I believe grassroots activism is the only way. And grassroots activism that happens through social media and podcasts and whatever way we can bring ourselves together and mobilize as a people, that's the only way reforms that matter are going to happen. And so I like to tell people, if you see a proposed idea for some kind of reform with regard to sexual assault, if you see it in the newspaper or on television, there's a very good chance it's not a good idea because women are not in charge of those places where those changes are happening. And there's a very good chance that what looks to be good is a Trojan horse and it's actually going to undermine something that matters to women. So be suspicious. Be suspicious. See critical consumers. Question everything you read about whether a proposed reform in the context of violence against women is actually good for women. Ask questions. Dig deep. Use the internet. Use common sense. You know, don't accept what you read as true, et cetera, et cetera. And if you're that kind of consumer of information, whether it's from the courts, whether it's, you know, substantive information or language choice, if you're a critical consumer, you're going to help. You're going to help a lot. You're going to help to bring about meaningful reforms. And in a very powerful way, you're going to help put a stop to violence against women.
Well, thank you so much for that. And I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Wendy Murphy. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.